So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and joining me from New York is Rachel Sklar.
Hello.
How is your recovery going from South by Southwest? You were there for what, 3 weeks?
Certainly felt like it. I got back on Sunday night, and I was actually just wondering, like, how long I can claim that I'm recovering from South by Southwest, particularly when everybody else came home a week earlier. So I think I probably need to retire that line, but I am still recovering.
Okay. And now I know we talked. You were on the show last week, and you talked a lot about the interactive show. You were also at the music part of it, and I've heard, you know, we have Jason Feinberg has kind of written about what's going on in the music part of it, but it seems like technology is definitely creeping into the music part of South by Southwest too.
Absolutely. I actually think it would behoove South by Southwest to do a lot more overlap between interactive music and film. The only limitation on that, of course, is pure physical space. Interactive moved out of the hotels and music basically moved in. So they'll have to figure that out. But it seemed to me like there was plenty of room for overlap. And I actually thought that I was going to be sort of not that busy during the music part. And there was tons for me to do on the interactive side as well.
Yeah. And were there any good bands that you saw?
Yeah, actually, I had a really good time. So my strategy for enjoying music is not to go hunting for the bands I already know, but to wander into various events and discover new bands. And
right.
I actually did that. I think I mentioned to you, but I will tell our audience. Eric Kuhn, who is the social media agent at UTA, introduced me to Mike Cowan, who by day is the head of original programming at Demand Media, but by night is a lead singer of this band, Tournament of Hearts, which features a bunch of Canadians. I'm Canadian, so automatically these guys were dear to my own heart, I guess. And so I had fun going to their shows, and I really like them. So, and I actually arranged like a random pop-up acoustic show for them in the Hilton where I was staying. So that was really fun. They're a fantastic band, and some good media and Canadian content. I also have some Austin favorites, the Midget Men, which I went to their show. They put together a really amazing showcase, and they have a really fun, loud punk sound. And I wandered into a bar and heard this amazing band from, I think, from somewhere in North Carolina, now I'm blanking on where, called Delta Ray. And there was, they're like a brother-sister act that sort of like encompasses kids that they grew up with. And they had an amazing sound. They were all so talented. They're very arcade fiery in the way that they would all switch positions and instruments. So those are my top three sort of random, you haven't heard of them, but you've heard of them now bands.
Yeah, that's what's so fun about being down there. It's just that there's music really literally on every corner and every store. Anywhere you could set up a stage, there's music. And so the chance of just running into something random is so high. And that's what makes it fun, because trying to actually make it to shows on time is difficult. And then you get in these lines and it gets very complicated.
Yeah, and you know, it's just so much more fun to wander. I was really, after interactive, where I was so targeted and directed with everything I was doing, all I really wanted to do was wander. So that's a word I will continue to say. You know, I thought about trying to go to Bruce Springsteen. That's my one regret, is that I just thought it would be too difficult. And it turns out that it was not that difficult. I knew a lot of people who went. So I really wish that I'd seen Bruce. I didn't go because I thought it would be overwhelming with the crowds, and so that's my one big regret.
Yeah, well, there'll be probably other chances to see him in other venues, I would guess.
Yeah, no, I have seen him, but it would have been great. I'm a Bruce girl.
So for this show, we're talking about the new Pew Research Center has just come out with their State of the News Media, which is this massive annual report about just how, you know, the news media is doing in every different sector. And so we'll talk about what 2011 brought to the news business, and kind of the typical kind of trend of online doing better and print doing worse. And we'll have Amy Mitchell from Pew Research Center come on and talk about that. Then we'll talk about Yahoo sued Facebook over patent infringement, over some patents that were years old and right during Facebook's quiet period, right in the run-up to its IPO. And so the question is, you know, does Yahoo have standing to do this? Are they kind of becoming a patent troll? You know, is this going to work out for Yahoo? And we'll have a couple guests on, one a patent lawyer and another journalist, who will talk about kind of the merits of Yahoo's case and just, you know, what this means about the patent law in general. But first, let's start with the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which is part of the Pew Research Center. They put out their State of the News Media report, and we'll bring on Amy Mitchell to talk about that. So Amy Mitchell is Deputy Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. She's involved in all aspects of designing, managing, and writing the project's in-depth research studies, including the State of the News Media Report. She's authored and co-authored several works, including Thinking Clearly, Case Studies in Journalistic Decision-Making, and is a frequent lecturer on the changing landscape of news. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So looking at this just massive report that you guys do every year on the state of the news media, I guess part of it was a little predictable that, you know, the online did so well. The online audiences for news rose 17% last year, and online ad revenues were up 23%. And meanwhile, some of the print sectors didn't do as well. Newspapers particularly lost 4% of their audience and 7% of ad revenues last year. And online and cable news were the only sectors that really grew in ad revenues last year. What would you say were kind of the big highlights of your report this year?
Well, one of the valuable things about doing a report like this is being able to gather together all of this data and then sort of take a step back and say, okay, what does this all add up to? What are the big, you know, the big things that are really cutting across the news industry overall? And one clearly that we saw this year was the establishment, if you will, of the mobile news era, and in many ways the multi-device era, where we now have almost a quarter of the population that are getting news on multiple digital devices. And the behavior, the ways people are getting news on these devices, much of the research suggests seems to be ways that are adding to their news consumption, where people are taking advantage of these news options to be able to turn to news at different times of the day, to read longer articles on the tablet than they used to read on their desktop or their laptop, to turn in more frequently through apps than they used to do, and by strengthening in some ways the relationship with news organizations. We see a greater number of people saying they're going directly to news organization websites or apps to get their news, as opposed to getting news in other ways. But if you then look at the revenue side, you see that the news industry itself may not be benefiting so much from this new consumer interest and this consumer behavior. We see the gap actually growing between the big technology companies and the news industry. You have now the five big technology companies accounting for almost 70% of all of the online ad revenue, and Facebook alone, as estimated by eMarketer, is expected to account for one out of every display ad dollars as of 2015, which is the kind of advertising that the news industry relies on most.
So in mobile, I mean, that makes a lot of sense that people, you know, obviously are snapping up more tablets. They're using their smartphones to get news. If they're still using kind of different platforms but still going to a lot of the traditional news sites and apps, what is it, do you think, that is this a failure on the part of the news organizations to monetize those new platforms? I mean, is it, what do you think the kind of the downfall is for them on that?
Well, the question is, how do you adapt what you've been able to produce and find new revenue streams to support the movement of the audience to the digital realm? And so far, that has not happened. Some of that is likely tied to the race to keep pace with the change and these new devices and all the new platforms that content needs to be able to be created on, which is not a natural part of these news organizations. That technology knowledge and the environment of change, which is ingrained in the fabric of these big technology companies, is a struggle when it comes to many of their traditional organizations. And there has not been a lot of success in keeping pace with that change and establishing new revenue streams.
Now, what about one of the things you talked about in the report was about Facebook, Twitter, and social media. A lot of traditional news organizations have been using that more and more. They're getting a lot more referrals from Facebook and Twitter. They're using it a lot more. But I guess what you found was that there wasn't as much, I guess, traffic coming from those places as a lot of people expected, or they're not kind of getting the payoff that they expected from those from social media?
Well, what we saw is that when you put that in context with all the other ways that people get news that have been around for a longer time, even in the digital realm, whether it's going directly to the news sites or using search or using some kind of organizer or aggregator of news, the social media is the newest player there. And if you look at the numbers, you can see that. When we ask people, how are you getting your news stories on these devices, only about a third as many said that they're getting them from links on Facebook or from Twitter very often, as are doing so in these other manners, in search or going directly to websites or using an aggregator or organizer. So they're very much still in the building process. Clearly, they're a part of the environment. They're a part of the landscape. They're a part of how people share news. But they're still a new player and aren't dominating news behavior and news consumption habits the way some have suggested.
This is Rachel. Just quick question. Did you take Pinterest into account at all in any of this? I know it's like a very recent phenomenon, but the buzz on Pinterest of late has been just how much traffic it's tending to drive.
You know, it's interesting. One of the other things I was going to mention is that if you couple the data that we have with what consumers are saying, where they're going to get their news, you know, how they're getting their news stories, with some of the audience behavior that's coming from Hitwise and others, they actually correlate pretty closely. And I know that some of the Hitwise data does include all social media, which includes the newer players as well. And their data show that about 9% of the traffic is coming from social networks.
And Pinterest might be a part of that as well.
Pinterest is included, I believe. Okay. I believe that reflects, you know, all social networks that they're tracking.
Is it something, I mean, in moving forward, is that something you're going to be looking at beyond just kind of Twitter and Facebook, but also Pinterest and other kinds of new, I know StumbleUpon is another one that people sometimes look at as driving traffic. I mean, is that something that Pew will be looking at more, or new platforms in social media?
Well, absolutely. In social media, you know, some questions we ask about specifically, you know, these were asked specifically about Facebook, specifically about Twitter. But in some of the other survey work we've done, we'll ask, do you use social networks to get news or to share news? And that, of course, you know, crosses the gamut of all the social networks that are out there. In this case, we wanted to specifically dig into a couple of them. So absolutely. I think a lot of what's interesting is the larger concept beyond the very specific websites, but how are you getting your news, and are you doing it in multiple ways? Are you for some instances, in some cases, whether it's by topic or area of interest, choosing to, you know, always go to one particular news app or website? Are there other things that you like to search for or have somebody help you organize if you want to follow health news or some other area where you want to get it from a lot of different sources? And are there instances where you like to see what your friends suggest you read? So how are people combining these different methods to fill in their daily news diet?
And I guess this is Rachel again. How are you defining news? Because I feel like, in my experience, it's sort of like the word news still connotes, quote unquote, serious news, headlines of the day, what's breaking and what's important, and read in a stentorian voice on the nightly news, versus Snooki's pregnant, who's the father. But that qualifies as news in the broader definition, and certainly for news consumption. There's no question that Snooki drives Patriots. So when you would send out the query about where do you get your news from, how would you define news?
That's a great question, and it's a difficult thing to address, particularly when you're asking people, you know, in these surveys who might have their own connotations for what it means. When we've done two surveys in the last year that tried to address this question in a couple of different ways, and in one case we did a survey of local news consumption, and we said we're breaking apart the definition of news and asking about very, very distinct topic areas, weather and traffic and local restaurants and the education system and tax information and all of these different areas, to really find out where do people turn for to get information about where to go to dinner versus where do they turn for weather and where do they turn if they want to know about the school system. And those results were very, very interesting and suggested that people are pretty knowledgeable and have made conscious decisions about where they're going to go for each piece of information that they need to know about in their local community.
I just wanted to talk about Snooki, really.
You got it in there.
Well, thanks a lot, Amy. Appreciate you joining us and talking about the report.
Thank you.
So now we'll talk about Yahoo and their lawsuits against Facebook for patent infringement. Facebook is now in its quiet period before an IPO, and Yahoo sued it for patent infringement over 10 different patents, many of them coming from years ago. Yahoo had done this before, right before Google's IPO, and so this is kind of this taking a page from its own playbook, and likely is hoping for some kind of settlement or payout, maybe in stock like it got from Google. A lot of people consider Yahoo to kind of be a patent troll, that they're, you know, causing trouble and kind of needlessly. One of the former Yahoo developers, Andy Bio, said that software patents should be abolished and the system is completely broken. So we'll have a couple guests on to talk about just the standing of this lawsuit and really where kind of what will happen and where Facebook, you know, is headed with these lawsuits. Edward Weiss is a partner in Cozen O'Connor's Intellectual Property Law Group in Midtown Manhattan. He has over 20 years of experience in patent prosecution and counseling, with a specific focus on electrical business method and software technology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Brad Plumer is a business reporter at the Washington Post. He was previously an associate editor at the New Republic. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So we have this lawsuit from Yahoo suing Facebook over patent infringement. And Ed, you've looked at a lot of these kinds of patent lawsuits before, and you know there's been just a flurry of lawsuits, especially in the technology realm and in the software realm. What do you think about this lawsuit in particular? Do you think Yahoo has a pretty strong case? What do you think about this? I mean, what did you think when you first heard about it?
I was not surprised by it. You know, people spend a lot of money on their patent portfolio, and they, you know, hire their engineers, software developers, and so on, for the sole purpose of creating something to distinguish them from their competitors. You know, that's why people have an IP budget on the patent side. Whether they're ready to, you know, pull out their weapons, so to speak, and use them in an offensive manner is usually, you know, that's where reasonable minds will differ. And I think that's where you see sort of the community fall on either side of the line here as well. As far as, you know, the strength, you know, they have a lot of patents there. Yahoo was one of the earlier players in you know, the internet. Some of these patent applications go back a ways, and you know, the burden is going to be on Facebook to try and establish that, you know, these patents are not valid, typically because they're trying to protect things that were known before the filing dates of those applications. Now, you know, again, I mean, Yahoo goes back a ways, so how many things were out there back then to be used in a defensive manner to challenge these patents successfully? You know, that's the question.
And so can Facebook, I mean, basically say something like, you know, some of these are about, you know, one of them is about a personalized web page. I mean, some of them just seem very broad where you could kind of take tons of people to court over it. I mean, can Facebook use that as a defense to say that some of the things that are being patented are just too broad and they haven't really protected them before?
You can't word it that way, but you know, basically what the patent covers is what the patent claims recite. So if you look at each one of these patents, they at the end of them, they have these numbered paragraphs which define the scope of protection. And a patent, you know, I'm generalizing, but a patent is valid if it was, you know, if what is disclosed in those claims was novel and not obvious from what was already in existence just about prior to the filing of the application. That's going to be the test. So what that means is the broader the claims, the easier it should be to challenge by hopefully being able to find something in the prior art that reads on those claims. If the claims are narrower, then it may be a little bit more difficult to find something that's going to read on those claims, right? You have a broader net, it's going to catch a lot more things, a lot more prior art is going to fall into that broad net. And if it's a narrower net, it's not going to catch as many, you know, as much prior art. But again, as I said it before, these patents are old. How much prior art was out there, even with a wider net, for you to catch? That's the question.
Now, Brad, I want to get your opinion on this. You've kind of been covering this for the Washington Post, and you had a really interesting post saying that you just thought, in general, that this is kind of another example of how software patenting process is kind of flawed. Is that, I mean, what's your take on the lawsuit?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where I come down on whether the process is flawed or not, but certainly there are a lot of people out there. Particularly, what's interesting is you get a lot of programmers, engineers, software developers who are really resistant to the idea of software patents in the first place. And there was an interesting essay written by one of Yahoo's former the guy who worked at Yahoo as a developer, and he helped develop some of the social network technologies that they eventually patented.
This is Andy Bio, right?
Andy Bio, yeah, he wrote this for Wired. And I don't believe any of those specifically were in the lawsuit. I would have to go back and double check. But one of the things he mentioned, you know, he was initially extremely reluctant to patent any of these technologies, and Yahoo sort of told him, well, we need to patent some of these things to protect ourselves against patent trolls, you know, these non-practicing entities that don't actually often don't use the patents, but will sue. So Yahoo said, we need to protect ourselves against this. And he was sort of dismayed to find that a lot of these patents are now being used offensively as weapons. And so there are certainly a lot of programmers who feel as if software patents are often for things that are so broad that they actually inhibit innovation, whereas you think of the patent process as something that's supposed to foster innovation?
You know, the thing to keep in mind, and I've heard those arguments by not just software developers, but by a lot of different inventors across the board who work for companies. But you know, the thing to bear in mind, I think, is where the patent law is coming from. You know, from day one. You know, the patent law was created to stimulate the exchange of the dissemination of information. That was the idea. You know, if you go back to when, you know, the Constitution, which is where these patent laws start, they are, you know, it goes against a person's nature to disclose their innovation to the public because they're concerned that they're going to lose their competitive edge. So people would keep things secret, and hopefully their competitors won't find out how they're making the, you know, how they're bottling milk the best way, or how they're developing their wagon wheels, or whatever the technology was. So in order to stimulate the dissemination of information, the patent system is set up as a reward system. And if you come up with something that is novel and not obvious, which you're disclosing in effect to the government, which will then publish it more recently as a patent application, but in the past as an issued patent, you know, your reward is a limited time of exclusivity to prevent others from practicing what your patent covers. And once that's published, your competitor now will be able to look at that and perhaps come up with an improvement over yours, which he never would have come up with if he never knew of your idea in the first place.
Well, what the process that you just described is a process wherein innovation is fostered and protected. And I think one of the big concerns, of course, is that in the world of patent trolls, you've got deep-pocketed organizations that are, you know, applying for patents left, right, and center so that they can then challenge the innovators who typically are spending their time innovating as opposed to, you know, hiring lawyers or having the deep pockets themselves to fight it. That's sort of the general startup ecosystem feeling on patent trolls. But in this particular example, I guess we haven't really spoken about what Yahoo's strategy is in doing this beyond, okay, they suddenly are noticing some valid claims that they have against Facebook, even though a lot of these patents were filed in the late 90s. And it's just the timing is oh so convenient. And one thing to note is that Yahoo era Google IPO is very different than Yahoo era Facebook IPO, namely that Yahoo as a company has been really struggling to find identity and to, you know, continue to capture market and to continue to innovate themselves over the past few years. And so to many in the system, in the ecosystem and in the community, this looks like an incredibly cynical grab for a piece of what Facebook as an innovator has built up. I mean, honestly, like, a word on the street is that Yahoo's making the Winklevi look good here. So what do you gentlemen think about that?
Well, that's certainly, I mean, the timing of it certainly does seem to support this case. I mean, one thing that is worth knowing is, you know, whether or not the system was set up for certain purposes, it certainly had some effects that perhaps no one could see at first, where you have a lot of technology companies stockpiling patents, essentially preparing for lawsuits. And one of the interesting things about Facebook is that it doesn't actually have many patents. I think it has something like 21 or so. And
that's right. I just checked that this morning. That's right.
Right. And so, you know, and that also leaves them in a very vulnerable situation. Often if it's two big companies going at it with patents, it's more likely that they'll be able to reach some settlement with a cross-licensing deal. And it's, you have this balance of power, but Facebook's in this position where they don't have very many patents and they're a lot more vulnerable.
Yeah, and Brad, you also mentioned in one of your stories just how difficult it would be for, let's say, someone starting out today as a startup to figure out when they're creating some kind of service, like who owns the patent to kind of everything that they're doing online.
Right. There's this interesting new paper, and Ed, I'd be curious to hear your take on this, by Christina Mulgan out of Yale and Timothy Lee out of the Cato Institute, where they basically say that software patents are a little different from other types of patents. If you have, say, if you're trying to patent a chemical formula, you can put it up on a, it's easily indexable. You can put up in a database. It's very easy to cross-check. You know, there's sort of no excuse for violating a patent on a chemical formula. It's very easy to find. And they say software patents are a lot more difficult to do that with. It's often extremely time-consuming to try to check whether you're violating a software patent. It's not always obvious, you know, what search terms you would necessarily use when you're filing the patent in the first place. And so they basically go through and look at all the different companies that use some form of software patent. You know, it can be anything from maintaining a website to using an internet-based invoice system. And if they want to check all that code for infringement, these two scholars who put out this paper basically said, you know, they estimate it would take something like 2 million attorneys working full-time to pore over the records. That's if every single company wanted to check. So not surprisingly, what you see is most developers don't actually, in practice, check for infringement. And there are stats on that. I mean, most of them just sort of plow ahead with development and hope for the best. So you have the system that starts to seem, when you really look at it, regardless of the moral principles behind it, starts to look a little impractical.
I definitely agree with you. I mean, doing patent searching over the years, I will tell you that when you're doing a patent search on, you know, an electrical device or a mechanical device, pictures speak 1,000 words, and you can look through these patents and get a feel for what is going on from the figures in the patent. With software, you can't really do that. Similar to chemical or method patents, basically you're looking at block diagrams, and it takes a lot more time because now you have to at least read it thoroughly just to even decide if it's worth, you know, further studying. So that's definitely true, and I agree with you. It is a minefield out there. But, you know, many companies, before they launch a product, they will engage in some type of freedom to operate study to see what's out there. And there are really no shortcuts other, you know, there are some strategies. For example, you know, competitors will always monitor each other's patent portfolios. Going back to Rachel's point before, you know, there was a reason why a year or so ago Google paid, like, I don't remember, $900-something million for Nortel's patent portfolio, because Google was in a similar position as Facebook. They did not have a lot of IP, you know, weapons in their arsenal, and they needed to beef it up. So they did it the easy way. They bought something that was sort of on the auction block. You know, I don't know if anyone looked, but I'll tell you, as of this morning, Yahoo has over 1,000 patents. And, you know, God knows how many pending applications they have, but they have, you know, 1,000 patents. 1,034 is the number that came up this morning. From what I understand from the, you know, media, they were in negotiations to try to work out some deal. And, you know, the deal fell through, so they finally pulled the trigger. And if they were going to ever pull the trigger, just from a business point of view, you'd certainly do it before, you know, the IPO is over.
Well, in fairness, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I believe they notified Facebook of the violation sometime in late February, February 27th or so, and then filed the lawsuit 2 weeks later, which you know, given, as I understand it, negotiations for licensing typically takes a few months, it seems to suggest that the attempt to negotiate a license wasn't particularly serious, although I'd be curious.
You and I would have both loved to have been a fly on that wall, I imagine.
No, that is true.
You don't know if it was simply a get out of here, this is ridiculous, we're not going to negotiate, right? Or, Apple has a similar situation, I imagine, because, you know, Apple is always getting sued on one thing or another. You know, the iPhone uses so many different types of technology and applications that, you know, someone always has something. And, you know, you probably see a similar thing now with Google and with some of these other companies. But, you know, from a business point of view, if you shell out a lot of money here, you know, you're going to have a reputation of paying, and other people, possibly, I'm not saying for sure, but I could certainly see that from a business strategy. Well, if we pay, we're going to have to keep paying, and it's going to just whatever. We're going to have to stand our ground and fight about it.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that for journalists is that I've noticed that a lot of the kind of the tech blogs and the kind of Apple insider blogs and all those people, they get a lot of really good information. I mean, they don't know that they know for sure, but when they see patents that are being applied for, they can kind of think, oh, this is where this company might be going with future products. You often see a lot of kind of broken stories broken that way just through patents that are being filed.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things, in my business is whenever you do patent searching, for example, you almost find like these technology nodes, if you will, where, you know, all of a sudden you find this one area and there's this big cluster of filings around that area because clearly that was the hot technology area at the time, you know, and then it sort of trickles out or branches out into other, you know, it's almost like a web, if you will. And you're right, by seeing where people are going and where competitors are going, they're clearly, you know, watching each other.
Well, then journalists have quite a lot of scoops to find in 1999 patent filings from Yahoo, because that seems to be where a lot of them were filed.
Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Todd.
One late-breaking note to add. After we recorded this show, the news came out from Bloomberg that Facebook had bought 750 patents from IBM to defend itself against the Yahoo lawsuit and other possible patent lawsuits. So we'll see how that plays out. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Our co-host is Rachel Sklar. We want to thank our guests, Amy Mitchell from the Pew Research Center, as well as Ed Weiss and Brad Plumer. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our new site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.